Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Mac Ramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. Well, the regular season is coming to a close, and the playoff picture is finally all clear. All the spots have been spoken for, and this week we're discussing the six postseason-bound teams that we haven't gotten to yet. The Cubs clinched on Wednesday, September 27th, sending the defending world champs back to the postseason. Here to talk with us is writer, Hardball Times contributor, and Cubs fan Shakia Taylor. Shakia, how are you doing?
Hey, I am doing fantastic.
Very glad to hear that. So to start off, the Cubs, they got off to a rocky first half of the season, trailing the Brewers by 5.5 games at the All-Star break. What improvements did the team make in the second half to erase the deficit and win the division?
A really big change the team made was the defense. In the first half, the defense underperformed like terribly. Lots of the miscues and errors that could have totally been avoided. I think they corrected that. Some player additions helped. And the players they added are already making an impact. Taylor Davis, Rene Rivera, Victor Caratini. The hitting changed tremendously in the second half. In August, the Cubs put up two 17-run games. Ian Happ, kind of a nice punny surprise. And I think they played with a sense of urgency in the second half. I joked around a few times with people, like, the Cubs are definitely still hungover from Champagne. But I think in the second half, by going from a sub-500 team to definitely a good team, they showed us that they're serious.
How far do the Cubs need to go in the playoffs in order for this season to be considered a success?
Well, personally, I think this season is already a success. Just because a team who won the World Series just clinched a division in back-to-back seasons, I don't think that's happened since, like, 2009, right? So that's already a big deal. But I think in Chicago there's this win-or-bust mentality now, which is interesting considering how long they went without winning. So I think the city, while they would appreciate a nice playoff run, I honestly think that most people here would consider it a success only to go back-to-back.
Yeah, I think that's what I would consider the team to really just be successful in kind of getting back to the playoffs, mm-hmm. Because that's in and of itself pretty rare to do, let alone rare for the Cubs organization to do. But speaking of the playoffs, are there any kind of major factors that need to go right for the Cubs in order to get back to or win the World Series?
Yeah, you know, So I thought about this kind of heavy, right? Because it's like you look at the team and you're like, last year the Cubs looked elite. This year the Cubs look great. And so I really was like, what are some things that, you know, they could do? And the first thing that came to mind was Ben Zobrist. Ben Zobrist has to get his hitting power back. I really think he, as a veteran, just how he played last year even, he really needs to contribute. Like, his presence needs to be felt in order for the Cubs to win. Not that they can't win without him, but I think they need him just to be a real impact player, which is what he was brought there for. I think the pitching and the bullpen, the Cubs' bullpen is atrocious. The fact that they're playing the Nats may actually be a positive for them in just this one instance alone, because the bullpen. I remember watching games and wanting to just throw up the poop emoji so bad. Wade Davis blew a save twice in the same game. Like, how does that happen? There's a lot of, like, pitcher regression. Jake Arrieta can't stay healthy. John Lackey's got an attitude problem. I mean, that guy gets so fired up on the mound, I am certain he's going to throw a punch. Like, he has to stay composed. I think the bullpen got lit up, basically. And I don't know if they need to calm down. I don't know if, you know, the pitching staff needs to go over fundamentals and mechanics, but they are going to be a big question mark. And my last one was a little difficult, but I think Javi Baez being more consistent at the plate is also a huge deal. Every time he goes to the plate, you never know what you're going to get. You never know if you're going to get Javi, who is swinging for the fences with no one on base. Get on base, dude. Get on base. I think he's talented. He's so talented. He's definitely a star. He can run. He can steal bases. His defense is incredible, but his plate appearances. Like, if Javi hits, Zobrist hits, bullpen steps up to the plate, I think the Cubs can win.
Yeah, Baez is such an electric player and so much fun to watch. I think baseball as a whole is definitely better when he's, you know, totally right overall. You know, even if he's great at the on the field, it would be nice to see that, you know, sort of be the case at the plate as well.
Right. I actually saw a quote on BP Wrigleyville that I thought was perfect to describe him. It said he had an enormous upside with fundamental flaws. That is accurate. Like, the guy's electric, but once he gets those fundamentals down, it's lights out.
And we have just one final question for you. Speaking about Lackey, how excited are you that he is likely going to retire at the end of this season?
I am very excited. I don't know if I've said this to any of you online, but I very strongly dislike John Lackey. Initially, it was fun to say that he was a Cardinals plant, but I'm happy he's retiring. I'm glad he got his jewelry instead of his haircut, but I can't say that I'll miss him.
I think we're all with
That's
you
putting
on
it
that.
Very politely.
It was never dull with him, but that's not necessarily a good thing.
He is special. He's very special.
Yes.
I mentioned his composure. Like, it's interesting seeing a pitcher lose it so frequently. And
yeah. It's like, you know, and it seems to be just kind of getting like earlier and earlier in the games as well. Kind of like he's having a competition over how early he can get ejected.
I think you could almost count on John Lackey having a first inning meltdown for a significant point in this season. And what's also weird is he was also the Cubs' most reliable pitcher for a long time this season, too. So, I don't know.
He's perplexing. It's probably best for his own mental well-being that this is probably the end for him.
Well, the Cubs will be facing the Nationals in the NLDS this upcoming weekend. Thank you again, Shakia, for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, you guys.
The Red Sox clinched a playoff berth on September 20th and wrapped up the division on September 30th. We just so happen to have a Red Sox expert right here, our very own Mary Craig. Mary, thanks for joining us.
It is my pleasure.
Chris Sale looked like a lock for the AL Cy Young for quite a while, but over the past 2 months, he has an ERA over 4, and he's getting hit much harder than he did in the first 4 months of the season. How concerning is this, and what's the overall outlook for the Sox rotation?
I mean, it's certainly not a development that has been welcomed by most of the Red Sox fans I know. I think it's pretty concerning. I think the most concerning thing is nobody's really sure why it's happening. We don't know if it's been overuse in the first half, and now he's just kind of like tiring out. But it's also kind of weird because he's either been pretty terrible or like totally lights out, you know, 8 shutout innings in the second half of the season. So it's a weird situation. I personally am not enjoying it. And I think it kind of puts up a lot of question marks for how he'll perform in the postseason, especially going up against Verlander, who is basically unhittable since he's joined the Astros. So I don't know which Chris Sale we're going to get in that game, if it's going to be the ace that we saw in the first half that was a lock to win the Cy Young, or if it's going to be this home run giver-upper who makes me look like an idiot for talking about how he was obviously going to win the Cy Young. So thanks for that, Chris. I really appreciate it. And then, of course, for the rest of the rotation, it's just kind of like a lot of mediocrity. You don't really have this one person that you can turn to that will kind of be the rock of the rotation anymore. So first off, Rick Porcello is terrible. I don't think anybody predicted that after he won the Cy Young last season. So that's kind of been a huge disappointment and a huge loss in the rotation. And then you have the tandem of Eduardo Rodriguez and Drew Pomeranz, and they've both kind of been pretty good. But again, they're very spotty pitchers. You never really know what you're going to get. And Drew Pomeranz has kind of been getting worse and worse over these past several months. And then with Eduardo Rodriguez, you're never really sure how far into a game he's going to go. He likes to throw about 7 to 5 innings, which, you know, isn't really great. So the rotation as a whole is just, you know, 3 to 5 question marks, which isn't really great when you're facing the top offense in the entire league. So I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see. Probably not going to be a lot of great pitching on the Red Sox side, but you never know.
Well, switching gears from pitching to offense, contrary to the previous season, this year's Red Sox offense has largely relied on small ball rather than home runs to score. Will this lack of power hinder them in the playoffs?
It's really tough to say. They've hit, I think, the fourth fewest home runs in Major League Baseball this season. So it's just been weird. I mean, you don't really have anybody who stood out. Like Hanley, I think, leads the team in home runs, but he hasn't been good at all. So they've had to rely kind of on manufacturing a lot of runs, which they've done with their speed and with taking a lot of risks on the base paths, some of which has paid off, some of which has made them look completely foolish. And so I think when you're facing a team like the Astros, who have like pretty good to great pitching, depending on who's starting, it's difficult when you kind of have to get, you know, 8, 9, 10 people on base to drive in 3 or 4 runs, as opposed to, you know, getting 2 to 3 runs with one swing. And I think that because the pitching, the Astros pitching, doesn't really allow a lot of people on base, so it's going to be difficult to compile a string of people on base at once. And again, the Astros have a really good defense, so it's not like the Red Sox can pressure them into making too many throwing errors. Kind of relied on to score a lot of their runs, especially in the past few weeks. So I think it probably will factor in at some point, hopefully later rather than sooner. But if anything like what happened last year happens to them, then it's going to be really difficult for them to score runs without any sort of home run threat.
What is your preferred path in the playoffs for the Red Sox, and can your heart handle another Red Sox-Yankees ALCS?
I'll go with the second part first and say no. And also, I don't think there are many people who want that. Just talking about baseball fans in general, they've been exciting, but they're also pretty torturous series, especially with the advent of social media. It's probably not going to be great if it ends up being Red Sox Yankees. So I think my preferred path, because it is 2017, 10 years after the 2007 Red Sox won, and it's already kind of set up this way, so they face an AL West opponent, this time the Astros instead of the Angels, but like whatever. And then I think it would be great if they could go for the Indians and beat the Indians again. And then I would like to see, the Rockies in the World Series and them to beat the Rockies again. I think that would be pretty great, pretty good symmetry going on there.
I respect that argument. Just, you know, you're the one who's asking for your team to play in Coors. So you just remember that, Mary.
Okay, I know. But they fared well there last time, so.
Fair enough.
So I'm optimistic. I mean, not optimistic they could ever get to the World Series, but you never know. By they, I mean both the Rockies and the Red Sox.
Yeah, I don't think the favorites in that.
No.
But, I mean, that's the beauty of baseball. You just never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I guess especially since the Astros and the Red Sox are facing each other so many times in, you know, the span of a week, that I guess, like, anything could happen, but also the Astros kind of look unbeatable, and it took the very best of the Red Sox in their offensive production getting hits from everybody today to beat them, so I don't know how many times you'll see that, especially ending up down 1-0 after Verlander goes.
Yeah, it looks like it's going to be an interesting series at the very least.
Yes.
And of course,
I will say that the Red Sox have the second best bullpen in baseball. So if the starters don't go deep into games, but also don't give up a lot of runs, the Red Sox could win, but I can't see the Astros not scoring because their offense is so high-powered.
Yeah, but we've seen these past few MLB playoffs that a good bullpen can go a long way, so that's a very good asset to have.
David Price turns into Andrew Miller, and there we go.
So, yeah, the Red Sox will be facing the Houston Astros in the ALDS, and Mary, always good to have you on every episode.
Thank you. I appreciate that because you're not getting rid of me.
The Diamondbacks clinched a wild card spot on Sunday, September 24th, marking the first time they've made the postseason since they won the division in 2011. Here to talk about them with us is Trisha Garcia, managing editor of Venom Strikes, the fan-sided D-backs site. Trisha, how are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So I guess just to get started, all major projections peg the Diamondbacks as finishing below 500 this season. Instead, they're finishing the season with upwards of 90 wins. What has gone right for them that people probably didn't expect?
I think they, compared to last year, I think that this year isn't the fluke. Last year was kind of the fluke. I was in the clubhouse a lot, and they were a talented team last year, too. But this year, I think bringing in Torrey Lovello from Boston has really made a difference. But also, obviously, adding J.D. Martinez at the trade deadline. And then they brought in two veteran catchers, Jeff Mathis and Chris Iannetta, and it's really helped them work better with their starting pitchers, and it's just taken off, and it's been incredible to watch.
How good is Arizona's offense, and was J.D. Martinez the best acquisition of any team at this trade deadline?
I think it's easy to say that J.D. Martinez was absolutely the best acquisition maybe ever. That's a lot to say, but he's been incredible. And yeah, their offense was good, especially in the first half. Jake Lamb was kind of the star of the first half, and Paul Goldschmidt together. And after the second half, Jake Lamb started to slump a little bit, or a lot. But J.D. Martinez came in and he picked it up, and him and Paul Goldschmidt have been this incredible duo together. And then looking at J.D. Martinez alone has been even more incredible. But I think it's been an all-around effort. Like, I wouldn't say that there's a significant part of the Diamondbacks lineup that's not doing well offensively overall. As you break down the months, you can start to see, like, Paul Goldschmidt's not having a good September. Jake Lamb did not have a good August. So you can see pieces there, but it's been a team effort.
Speaking for Dodger fans, I think we would also agree that JD Martinez is the best acquisition ever. It's been kind of unreal to watch what he's done since joining Arizona. Now looking at the wild card game, how do you feel with Zach Greinke on the mound heading into that against the Rockies?
It's interesting because, I mean, I think it's obvious that Zach Greinke is the Diamondbacks ace and has been with the huge contract they offered him about 2 years ago. But I was like, okay, Robbie Ray has been incredible. He's had a career season, and he's so young, and he's just done so well. I was really surprised that they didn't leave with Robbie Ray. But Zach Greinke's undeniable. He's great. And I think he does really well at home. So I don't think it was a bad choice. Are fans a little nervous? Yeah, he hasn't had the greatest last two outings. So I think there's a little concern, especially going up against John Gray. But they're going to be at home, and that's a different game for the Diamondbacks.
I think that it actually lines up kind of nicely for you guys just because Robbie Ray has pretty much dominated the Dodgers every time he's faced them, or at least that's how it feels. So having him lined up for that game one of the NLDS, if it gets to that point, I think that works out really nicely for them. And I have to say, Zach Greinke has been nails in the postseason. So I think things are looking good for you guys on that front.
Yeah, I hope that they get past the wild card to face the Dodgers because that's been such an exciting matchup all season long. And I can only imagine the rivalry that it'll bring in October.
Yeah, it's going to be one of the most exciting series if that is what ends up happening.
Agreed.
Yeah, so you can find Trisha on Twitter at Trisha with two A's, Nicole. Trisha, thanks so much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me, guys.
Anytime.
Looking at the AL wild card, the Yankees clinched a playoff berth on September 23rd, and with the Red Sox taking the division, New York's been relegated to the top wild card spot. Here to talk about them with us is Stacey Gotsoulias, who is the editor-in-chief at BP Bronx. Her writing can be found at a whole bunch of places, too, including the Hardball Times. Stacey, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good.
Yes, so a lot of unexpected things have happened during this Yankee season, mostly for the better, particularly Aaron Judge hitting the 50 home run mark. How did this Yankee team defy expectations in what was predicted to be a rebuilding year?
I think everything that happened was unexpected. I remember I went on a podcast, I can't remember which one, but I said that it was the type of team that could win anywhere between 80 and 89. And I figured that if everything went right, they could win 89. And if things went wrong, they would be down around 80. Because, you know, the years that the Yankees haven't made the playoffs recently, the Yankees are different than other teams. When they're bad, they're not awful. They don't, you know, they're not like 20 games below 500. They're just like just missing the playoffs. And I figured that it would be another year like that where they'd finish like, you know, maybe like 84 and 78. And in the beginning of the season, you know, they were doing really well, but, you know, that had happened in recent years and then they fell off. But, you know, when it got to July and they were still hanging in there and then they were doing the whole, you know, we're buyers thing. And I'm like, okay. And, you know, Judge at that point was, I think he was up around 30 or 32 home runs. And, you know, Didi Gregorius, 25 home runs this season. And Brett Gardner hit 20 for the first time at 34. So like so many things that happened this season was they were just totally unexpected. And it was just funny because if you think about it, Gary Sanchez was lost for a month. Didi Gregorius was lost for a month. CC Sabathia stayed healthy the whole year, won 14 games. Masahiro Tanaka basically became like Michael Pineda where one start he'd, you know, throw a complete game shutout and the next start he'd give up four home runs. It was just a really odd season. Good, but yeah, it was unbelievable.
Not that I really want to entertain this thought as a Red Sox fan, but how do you think the Yankees match up against the Twins in the wild card game and what would they need to do to win?
I feel like I'm really nervous about this, but I'm always nervous around the playoffs. I feel like it's a trap game. I feel like too many people are picking the Yankees and assuming that they're going to move on and play the Indians in the playoffs. you know, that whole one game, I mean, anything can happen in one game. And even though the Yankees, I think they won the season series 4-2, the Yankees need to, you know, Severino needs to pitch better than he did the last time he faced the Twins. And the hitters need to actually hit with runners on base. That would be good. and if that happens and they get to the bullpen and, you know, they score more runs than Minnesota, then they'll win.
Are a lot of people feeling overconfident about the game because of how the Yankees have fared against the Twins in recent history?
I feel like, yeah, I don't feel the players are, but I feel like, you know, fans are. I feel like, you know, most of the people on TV are, and I just, it makes me uncomfortable. But I'm a pessimist, so I'm always expecting the worst. So I can, you know, expect the worst, and then when something good happens, you're happy. So, yeah.
I think you fit right in here with that mentality.
What would need to go right for the Yankees in the playoffs for them to win the World Series?
Well, the starting rotation would have to, you know, pitch well. You know, can't have Masahiro Tanaka giving up home runs all over the place. You know, the hitters would have to get timely hits. They'd have to stop stranding runners because that was a big problem. And the bullpen would have to be lights out because that was another problem. I mean, as good as the bullpen was, when they were bad, they were awful. you know, Dellin Betances is another one where when he's really good, he's really good. But when he's bad, he is awful. And when his mechanics get screwed up, it's almost as if someone is remotely controlling his arm and he has no idea where the ball's going. So, you know, those sorts of things need to, like, everything just needs to be good in order for them to win. I mean, it could happen. Wild cards have won the World Series before. It wouldn't be a strange thing. I mean, it would be amazing if if the team that everyone thought was rebuilding actually won the World Series. Would be hilarious, but, you know, that would have to be it. Everything would have to go well for them to do it.
If they managed to make it through the divisional series, would you rather them face the Red Sox or the Astros?
The Red Sox.
See, I'm not sure I can handle that. I mean, yeah. I know we're, like, the worst team, but...
I think that they match up better against the Red Sox. For some reason, they don't do well against the Astros. And they're more familiar with the Red Sox. And that's... even though it would be, you know... I mean, that would be a real anxiety-inducing series for both sides. But it would be... I think it would be easier for both teams because they're so familiar with each other.
I think MLB would like that, too.
Yeah, I think so, too.
I think they would like the ratings that came along with that very much.
Yeah, so you can find Stacy on Twitter at @StaceGots. We appreciate you stopping by, Stacy.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome back anytime.
Thank you.
The AL wildcard race remained fairly tight leading up to the final week of the season, but the Twins have managed to pull away with the second spot, clinching on Wednesday. Here to talk about them with us is Maya Varda, managing editor at Twinkietown. Maya, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. So the Twins are the first team in MLB history to make the playoffs after losing 100 games of previous season. What are the differences between these two teams and what went right for the Twins this season?
There's probably actually fewer differences than you would think between these two teams. The rosters are very much the same. I mean, one of the things is that, you know, last season, these are really young guys. The Twins have had a lot of prospects. So you have your, you know, Byron Buxton, Miguel Sano, Jose Barrios, who started last season. And because those guys, you know, especially Buxton and Sano, have been talked about for so long, I think people think they're older, but they were just 22 and 23 when the season started. So last season, I think part of the thing that went so wrong for them in 2016 is just that it was such a young, inexperienced team. But there was a lot of other stuff. It was also sort of unlucky. I think any team, especially with that much young talent on it, for them to lose 103 games, which is the most in Twins history, you kind of have to have some, you know, bad luck in there too, because there was no way they were going to, you know, if they had lost 103 games again this year, I would have been probably more impressed than I am with them now, because that would have been really hard to do 2 years in a row. So that's kind of like the reason for the jump is just, you know, they did well in 2015, completely did not do well in 2016. So for them to get so much better in 2017, to me, it's not as surprising because I knew the talent was there. They were just so young. There was a lot of injuries, particularly to pitchers like Glenn Perkins, Torres Labrum, Phil Hughes had to get the rib removal thing. So that kind of hindered them too, because they were sort of going into 2016 thinking that they would be there. So the bottom kind of dropped out on that. But this season, they just have some more experience. And one of the biggest things is just the defense is so much better, especially in the outfield, because in 2016 they did the whole Miguel Sano and right field experiment, which went very poorly. So they had a bunch of pitchers that were sort of pitch to contact, and then they had this outfield that was, you know, Robbie Grossman, Danny Santana, and Miguel Sano, and that just did not work for them, which kind of contributed to the problems. But this year, they've had the best, I think, outfield defense probably in baseball, especially with Byron Buxton. They brought in Jason Castro, who is able to, I think his pitch framing and just his defense has been really helped the pitchers, along with, you know, the outfield defense. And so the pitching has done better, and it's just kind of elevated the whole team, even though it's a lot of the same people who were here in 2016. They didn't, you know, go and acquire any really big names or anything. They just kind of got older, got better defensively, kind of smarter roster management and that kind of stuff. So I think that's what has basically been the difference, but it's not as big as one might think.
Looking specifically at the season, the team spent a fair bit of the first half of the season leading in the division. Did Cleveland mm-hmm. just kind of turn on the Jets in the second half, or was there also some sort of stagnation with the Twins?
They did kind of turn on the Jets. If you have a 22-game winning streak, that makes a really big difference. The Indians, as far as I know right now, have only lost 20 games in the second half of the season, which, you know, when you go on a tear like that, it's you just can't really keep up with them. They didn't do quite, the Indians at least, in the beginning of the year, and the Twins started off really hot. They beat up on the Royals a lot. In the beginning of the year, they swept them to open the season, which kind of, you know, right away put them, like, out in first. But sort of in the later spring, the Twins were a little cold, but the Twins have they've been pretty hot, especially the past month. They kind of kept up. They could not keep up with the Indians and, the 22-game winning streak stuff, but I would say more of that was just about the Indians getting really hot, more so than the Twins stagnating. It was just sort of the Twins coming back down to reality, maybe. But their reality isn't that bad, so.
Well, looking at where the Twins are now heading into the wild card game, how much trepidation is there among fans about having to face the Yankees, and what will be the keys to winning the wild card?
I know. This is a question I was kind of dreading. I've been kind of joking myself and on the website just that, oh, we're going to lose that game, obviously, because it's against the Yankees, and they've had pretty much beaten up on the Twins for the past 16 years. I know the last two times the Twins made the postseason, they were swept by the Yankees in the first round and exited. But I think there's sort of a mix among fans, but I think the most interesting thing is that I feel like there's a lot more optimism among fans now than there was like 7 years ago in 2010, there was some optimism, but it quickly got shattered. But I just feel like fans just think that, you know, that this team can actually do it. We only have, you know, two players who were here in 2010, which was Glenn Perkins, who wasn't really a big in 2010. He was, you know, and Joe Mauer. So it's kind of like a completely new team, except for them. And we did well against them when they were here in July. We didn't, you know, they swept. We went there 2 weeks ago, I think, in the Bronx, and they swept us, which is a little bad. But I think the matchup of the pit, you know, Irvin Santana and Cervino, they did really good against Cervino 2 weeks ago. They knocked him out. I think it was the shortest start of the year, but, and Irvin Santana was good against them. So I'm kind of feeling, or is it Cervino? I don't know. Feeling good about that matchup. And I think that fans are feeling, a lot more positive about it than maybe in the past, or if it had happened, I don't know, before. I think that people are just, especially last, this week earlier, when they played the Indians on Tuesday, they came from behind in the eighth inning. Dozier hit a 3-run home run and they won that game. And I feel like that gave fans a lot of optimism. Like, we can do this. We're not just, you know, the 25-77, you know, or 85-77 team.
So you're feeling all right then about the prospect of facing Cleveland in the ALDS?
I think I'm more scared about facing the Yankees in the wild card than facing Cleveland in the ALDS. I know last year when the Twins were super bad, they were actually pretty good against Cleveland. I mean, for being that bad. So I do actually feel sort of positive about that, unless we just get trucked over by their pitching, which could happen. But I think there's a lot of optimism going around about the team, more so than I've maybe felt in a long time. Although the Twins haven't been to the playoffs since 2010, so it's kind of easy to say that.
Well, Maya, thank you for coming on. You can find Maya on Twitter at Kirby's Left Eye. Thank you again.
Thank you.
All right, we've now gotten to our final team. While a couple of NL Central teams got into within striking distance of them, the Rockies have held on to grab the second NL wild card spot. While our own Jinmak Ramos is a Giants fan, they have also written about the Rockies for Purple Row, and they're more than qualified to talk about Colorado's postseason outlook. Jin, pleasure to have you here.
Always glad to be here.
That's good. All right, so like last season, the Rockies finished third in the division, but this time they're headed to the playoffs, which is really exciting. How tough was it competing in the NL West, and what went right for the Rockies to nab a playoff spot?
You know, obviously the NL West, you know, for the top three teams has been an incredibly tough race. You know, you've got the Dodgers and the Diamondbacks ahead of the Rockies, and it's just been that, you know, the rest of the NL hasn't been as good. Obviously you have the race in the, you had the race in the NL Central with the Brewers and the Cardinals and the Cubs, but the NL East was such lackluster that, you know, it made things interesting for the wild card spot. Obviously, you know, being in such a strong part of the division, the Rockies would have had to make a huge push for, you know, even getting the first wild card spot. But, you know, just to make it into the playoffs, you know, they got their offense working for them. They figured out pitching. They had a lot of rotation struggles in the middle of the season, but ever since John Gray came back, you know, you've also got Tyler Anderson and Cal Freeland, and then moving Sensatella to the bullpen, you know, things have just kind of worked out for them. And, you know, it was also in the Rockies' favor that the Cardinals were able to beat the Brewers when they did.
Right, and speaking of things that have gone right for the Rockies, Charlie Blackmon had a really good year last season, and he's eclipsed it this year to become one of the best players in the league. What has he meant to the team?
He's meant an incredible deal to the team. I mean, obviously, he's a fan favorite, but to have him perform the way that he's been doing while, you know, Carlos Gonzalez hasn't been as Carlos Gonzalez as possible, you know, Charlie Blackmon's been there kind of picking up the team a little bit more and, you know, just kind of leading them into into this, you know, offensive outburst that keeps the team in games and keeps them competitive.
Speaking, I guess, more about things going right, what exactly needs to go right for the Rockies in order for them to beat the Diamondbacks in the wild card game?
I think that the offense needs to compile as many hits against Greinke as possible. That's going to be the hardest task for them. I don't think that there's going to be that much of an issue, whether it be, you know, home field advantage for the Diamondbacks. I don't think that that's going to be too much of an issue, but it's really just going to be about how many hits and how many runs could they score off of Greinke, and can they get to the bullpen sooner? They're going to have a lot of patient at-bats. They're going to have to work the count. They're going to have to work, they're going to have to make Greinke work a little bit more and have John Gray do his thing. It's really all focused on the offense at this point. John Gray has proven himself as kind of the ace of the Rockies rotation, but at this point it's all coming down to whether or not they can get the hits, they can get the runs. You know, they're gonna have to play some small ball. But in any case, if they can get Greinke out in 5 innings or less, you know, they've got a good shot to win it.
Are you excited about the possibility of making Gray puns if the Rockies win the game?
Absolutely, yes.
Excellent. And does this then kind of carry over into you possibly rooting for the Yankees to make it to the World Series against the Rockies so that you have two Grays?
Possibly, if only I could just say that there would be, you know, multiple shades of gray in this World Series. I would root for that.
But you wouldn't go so far as to say that you're waiting on a sunny gray, would you?
Oh my god.
It's a little Springsteen humor, yes. For all you dads out there listening.
I very much appreciated that. But yeah, I wouldn't say that I'm waiting on a sunny gray. I think, you know, the Yankees and the Twins, it's going to be a good game, but I don't know how that one's going to match up. But a gray versus gray World Series game would be quite interesting. Because we had such a full slate with Clinchmas topics, we're once again forgoing Twitter questions, but those should be back next week. Here's a look at last week's Hardball Times articles. Mary?
On Monday, we have May I Have Your Autograph, Please? By Richard Bergstrom. Linked together by the common question, may I have your autograph, please? Richard navigates us through a series of autographs he collected throughout his life and how learning politeness has served him in his life. With the bounty of players mentioned in this piece, from Jose Canseco to Larry Anderson, there's bound to be a story that resonates with everyone. Then on Tuesday, we have another edition of Card Corner Plus, this one titled Gene Michael and High Intelligence in 1972 Tops, and of course by Bruce Markison. So in this edition of Card Corner Plus, Bruce unpacks Gene Michael's 1972 card, the only one of his that shows him fielding. The card, an action series card, particularly displays Gene's intelligence, which was a hallmark of his throughout the rest of his career, both as a player and as an executive. Indeed, it was his shrewd intelligence that powered the Yankees in the late 90s and early 2000s. To reminisce and learn about this man's involvement in these Yankees teams, head over to Hardball Times and check out Bruce's article. Then on Wednesday, we have The Possible Dream, the 1967 AL Pennant Race, The Conclusion, by Shane Tortolot. At the beginning of the final week of the season, all four teams were within 1.5 games of the league lead, with Minnesota in first and Detroit in last. Travel days and weather interfered with this final week, setting up the last 2 days of the season as a winner-take-all situation. Though the final results are well known, it's worth reading about just how the Red Sox managed to secure the victory, particularly since it involved beating the Yankees and setting up Yastrzemski to become a Boston legend. All right, over to you, Sarah.
Thank you, Mary. On Thursday, we have Foul Balls by Rachel McDaniel. In her first piece for the Hardball Times, Rachel McDaniel, who now writes for BP Toronto, discusses her journey into the world of baseball writing. She presents us with a brief history of women writing about baseball and of one particular reporter, Allison Gordon, whose book, Foul Balls, was key in inspiring her to pursue her dream. While every baseball writer's path is different, anyone who's written about baseball will no doubt find something they connect with in Rachel's piece, especially if you're a woman. And then finally on Friday, we have What Walk-Up Music Reveals About Baseball by Mina Dunn. Friend of Hardball Times Audio, Mina is back, this time with an entertaining article about walk-up music. She takes us through a history of the origins of walk-up music, dating back to the 70s and White Sox organist Nancy Faust, who would choose songs fitting for particular players, as well as relevant tunes for events throughout the game. Players now pick their own music, and Mina has fun delving into what particular song choices may tell us about particular players.
And for next week, on Monday, we have David Kagan on the physics of the bat flip. Tuesday, we have Alex Remington on the wild card turning 23 years old. On Wednesday, we have David Studeman on Jim Albert's new book. On Thursday, Ryan Pollock visualizes hitter aggression. And on Friday, newcomer Timothy Malcolm has an oral history of the Phillies and Mets games on the final day of the 2007 season. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times Audio. You can find all the articles mentioned in this episode at fangraphs.com/THT, and you can find the site on Twitter at @hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter at @JenMacRamos. You can find Sarah at @SarahWexler32, and you can find Mary at @MaryMCraig. Thanks to all of our guests, Shakia Taylor @CurlyFro on Twitter, Stacey Gotsoulias @StaceGots, Trisha Garcia @Trisha2As, Nicole, and Myja Varda @Kirby'sLeftEye. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times Audio on fangraphs.com/THT and iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode.